Hello, I'm Frank Kermit. This is number 0157, the Stuff File Program, with your host, Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0157. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet military historian David O'Keefe, who talks about what he uncovered while putting together the documentary Dieppe Uncovered, about Canada's historic defeat of World War II. What made him question the Battle of Dieppe?
Growing up as a Canadian, Dieppe is always there. It's ever-present, and particularly as a military historian. And I think over the years, I mean, all the excuses that have been put forward just really have not registered with me. They've just never satisfied me intellectually. So as a result, I looked at it as kind of one of the greatest mysteries in all of Canadian history, and to be honest, one of the greatest mysteries in the entire Second World War.
Raymond Benson is the author of The Black Stiletto, a five-book series that features a masked female vigilante hero.
She was a vigilante in the late 1950s, 1960s, costume vigilante, kind of a female version of the Shadow. And she fought crime and social injustice, and she was active for about 5 years, and then she mysteriously disappeared. Nobody knew who she was. And in the ensuing years, she kind of became a pop culture icon with, you know, comic books about her, and she became the stuff of myth. Then we cut to the present. A grown man is taking care of his elderly mother who has Alzheimer's in a nursing home, and he discovers, lo and behold, that she was the Black Stiletto.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. On this edition of Book Banter, we're taking a trip to Planet Tad, along with a couple of other of my favorite young adult books. So get ready to blast off on the Stuff File Program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0157, was Frank Kermit, a relationship coach, author, and educator who is available for private coaching for singles and couples for all kinds of loving relationships by phone, Skype, and in person. His website, by the way, is franktalks.com. That's www.franktalks.com. And I thank you very much, Frank, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? On a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, on the one hand, 27-year-old Justin Gilpatrick made a wise decision not to drive home after a night of heavy drinking at a Portland, Oregon bar. His mistake was his choice to curl up in a recycling dumpster to sleep off the booze. Waste management crews emptied the contents of the dumpster, including Mr. Gilpatrick, into a compactor truck at around 1 a.m. The truck driver drove for about a quarter of a mile and compacted his load twice before hearing Gilpatrick's terrifying screams. Gilpatrick survived largely because the truck was relatively empty, which worked it to his advantage. So our boy was shaken but okay and taken to the hospital with only minor injuries. Waste management spokesperson Jackie Lang commended the truck driver for handling the situation and said, "This is a well-trained truck driver doing his job. He heard something unusual and immediately pulled over and shut down all the moving parts of the truck." Meanwhile, Gilpatrick wrote to his friends on his Facebook page, "I have not had a drink in years, and the one time I do, this is what happens. I will never drink again." Wow, well, that brings new meaning to the term getting trashed, doesn't it? And when it comes to nudist resorts, it is kind of interesting that whenever you see pictures of them, there always seems to be a whole bunch of old people. Yeah. Well, Florida's Sunsport Gardens Nudist Resort is trying to change that and plans to hold a weekend bash targeted specifically to nudists aged 18 to 30. The Florida Young Naturist's fourth annual End of Summer Naked Bash is slated to be a celebration of nudity and body acceptance. Sunsport Gardens principal shareholder Morley Schloss says the park has been trying to bring in younger members with lower fees, 24-hour hot tubs, and Friday night drum circles. Now, the gathering at the 40-acre park in Loxahatchee is expected to gather several hundred young adults. Meanwhile, nudist resorts around the country have been working to attract a younger crowd. I don't know. Those nudist resorts do have a high number of older folks, and the younger ones they're trying to attract still probably have 20/20 vision. Could be an interesting weekend. And Sue Hubbard of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, was sure that the man she saw floating in the river on Thursday was a drowning victim. Well, police, firefighters, and even a coroner were called to the scene, and they too were certain the poor guy was dead. But as the emergency team was trying to figure out the best way to remove the body from the water, the man who was wearing a life jacket suddenly sat up. Needless to say, everyone was pretty freaked out. The county coroner, Charles E. Keisling, said, "Let me tell you, it was quite a shock for us. He was bobbing up and down in the water, and he really looked like he was dead. Turns out our drowning victim," and yes, once again I'm doing air quotes, Joseph D'Angelo, later said he had just taken a nap in the river. He happened to wake up when a dragonfly landed on his nose. He said, "I didn't mean to worry anyone, but on a summer day, it's nice just to float and forget your troubles." Wow, that is one really relaxed dude. That's all I'm saying. And we have time for one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. When Brendan Tudor looked at his windshield following a bird depositing a nice splat of poop, he didn't see poop at all. What he saw was pop. To be more precise, the king of pop. Yes, the bird poop dropping on Tudor's 1996 Cadillac DeVille bore an uncanny resemblance to the late Michael Jackson. Tudor noticed the droppings looked even more like Jackson after they hardened. His plan was to auction off the windshield on eBay for a minimum bid of $500, but the auction ended without a single bid being received. Quelle surprise. Anyway, plan B was to sell it on a Chicago radio station until something happened, and it kind of changed all that. It kind of rained on his parade. Actually, it was actual rain. It rained. It seemed that Tudor's way of protecting his prized bird poop was to simply cover it with a piece of plastic cut from a sandwich bag and secure that down with scotch tape. Now, it worked for a few summer showers, but then a heavy rain came and the poop and Michael Jackson were all washed away. But Tudor still sees money to be made from the Jacko bird poop. He plans to sell T-shirts and other items featuring photos of the long-lost or the long-gone guano at a Facebook page that he's created. Yeah, this is a whole new level of sad. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? August 19th, 1942 is considered to be a dark day in Canadian military history. That was the day during World War II that an amphibious assault on Nazi-occupied France went horribly wrong, leaving 907 Canadian soldiers dead. But there is new evidence that shows that the doomed Dieppe raid had a vital mission. It is evidence that was uncovered by military historian David O'Keefe, and his findings are part of a new documentary film called Dieppe Uncovered that premiered 70 years to the day of the raid on the History Channel and will be repeated several times. David O'Keefe joins us on the line right now from Montreal. Hi, David.
Good evening, Peter.
It's an interesting story, and we've all been taught, at least most of us, we're taught what happened in that raid. What made you dig deeper to uncover what you found?
Well, I guess, you know, growing up as a Canadian, Dieppe is always there. It's ever present, and particularly as a military historian. And I think over the years, I mean, all the excuses that have been put forward just really have not registered with me. They've just never satisfied me intellectually. So as a result, I looked at it as kind of one of the greatest mysteries in all of Canadian history, and to be honest, one of the greatest mysteries in the entire Second World War. So that's really what started me on the journey many years ago.
Did you have any inkling when you started that you would find something, or in other words, did you have an idea where you were going, or were you caught by surprise by what you indeed discovered?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was caught by surprise. There was one document that was released about 15 years ago, and this had to do with a special commando unit that was raised to pinch or steal what was considered to be ultra-secret material. Now, this had to do with German codes and ciphers, and of course the Allies were breaking into the vast majority of the Axis communication during the war. It was one of the greatest secrets of the Second World War, and of course also it became the lifeblood of Allied decision-making. So when I came across this document, I actually looked down, you know, reading it as anybody would, and then I got to the fourth paragraph, and there was this one little throwaway line, which simply said, the party at Dieppe did not reach its target. And I was absolutely shocked, because this was the first time that I'd ever had anything in my hands of an ultra-secret nature that was directly related to the Dieppe raid. Now, of course, that's where the mystery started, and this was 15 years ago. And when I started to, well, attempt to flesh this out, there just wasn't that much in the public domain at that time to really flesh it out. So it was kind of like being given one big juicy jigsaw puzzle piece, but without anything else. And that's how the journey started.
Now, when you did this immense research, you must have come across people who might have been survivors of this very battle.
Yes, I did, certainly.
And
it was one of those, for years you had always heard those stories, and many of these veterans have always, worn this sort of like the albatross around their neck, if you will, a scarlet letter. I mean, many of these guys trained in England for 2 years without seeing any action, and then finally they got a chance to get into action on August 19th, and for a lot of them, their war was over in a heartbeat. They were either killed, wounded, or captured and spent the rest of their, whole war in prisoner of war camp. And then they ended up coming back, and for years, literally for 70 years, they have never been able to figure out what it was that they were sent to Dieppe for.
Well, that was my question. What you've uncovered was stuff that they didn't even know about, correct?
You're absolutely right. I mean, with the exception of about 15 or 20 of these commandos, this special commando unit, the rest of the troops on the ground, generally speaking, did not know. But that's part and parcel of the way the military operations are conducted. It's part of security. You only need to know as much as you need to know to accomplish your objective. And of course, all the objectives are interlocking. So you don't necessarily have to tell a Canadian infantryman from a particular regiment what the Royal Marines' objective would be, just that this Canadian infantryman has to reach his objective because there's an important reason. You don't have to tell him what it is.
Now, you said that this was like an albatross around the neck of those who have survived this after all these years. Now that the story is out, now that your documentary is available, have you heard from some of these men, the ones that are still alive? I would assume there are very few of them.
There are very few that are still left. I mean, we interviewed five of them, but we've actually featured three in the documentary. And it was a rather remarkable experience because as a historian, I'm used to interviewing veterans, but I'm not necessarily used to sharing my findings with them. Or at least immediately in capturing it on film. And it was my production partner, Wayne Abbott, who actually suggested that we do this, that we actually show the evidence to the veterans and then see the reactions after. So we filmed them before, and of course they gave the standard interpretation. And then when we actually took them piece by piece through the evidence, it was remarkable to see how much their views had changed. And one of the veterans that we spoke to, and we actually featured in the film, is Ron Beale, who landed at Blue Beach with the Royal Regiment. And he was so stunned and so shocked, finally, after all these years, that he actually turned to me while we were doing this. And we didn't catch this part on film, but he looked at me and he said, Dave, he said, now I know why my friends died, and now I can die in peace.
Wow.
And of course, as a historian, I was struck at that moment by the absolute power of the results of the research. And of course, as a historian, I went back and crossed my T's and dotted my I's, because you realize just how powerful these findings are and will be for those who were there.
Did you come across any roadblocks in your way in the name of, say, for instance, military secrets while trying to ascertain this information?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the ways that the various governments, in this particular case, the British government, release material is that they do it in a very protracted way. So you don't get this huge thunderclap of material dropped in your lap, or one, you know, secret behind the EP file, if you will. It's very much like detective work, where you have to piece everything together. So over one of the reasons why it's taken 15 years is because of this protracted method of releasing material. So again, if we go back to the idea of a jigsaw puzzle, every year more pieces would be put into the box, and then slowly the picture would form. And then finally, 15 years later, now we can get the full story. But without a doubt, it was sensitive, because a lot of the methods and sources that they were using in World War II still have a certain validity on the battlefield today. Pinch operations are still part of military operations that are going on in Afghanistan and Iraq and other places in the world. So they were a little sensitive about it.
Well, that was actually my next question. Now that you know what you know about Dieppe, I mean, what drew your attention to this is the fact that, to be frank, it was an operation that didn't succeed and so many Canadians died. But having said that, what you know about this particular operation, does it make you think any differently about other operations you have studied that maybe were successful? In other words, their complete motive, as opposed to what we just generally know about those particular battles?
Well, I think that's sort of where, you know, history is leading us, the historiography, our understanding of various events in history. And I think that's what the research into Dieppe does. It creates a new paradigm for us to look at other battles. And I think that's really where the research is going to go, at least personally. That's where my research is going to go. And I'm going to be applying the methods that I did for Dieppe to, you know, things like Normandy, like Italy, and all the other battles of the Second World War in particular. The other thing that I've noticed is that our understanding of Dieppe changes dramatically. Yes, it's a disaster. It will remain a disaster. There were problems with the planning. There were problems with the execution. And let's face it, 907 Canadians died, and close to 1,000 other Allied soldiers, sailors, and airmen also died. Nothing's going to change that. What the research does is changes our understanding of why they were there, what the purpose was. And if you will, there is a silver lining to what Dieppe was all about. But like I said, it's kind of sad that it's taken 70 years for those who were there and those who were left to actually find out.
What has our government in Canada said about this?
Well, right now, because the results of the research are rather new, it's dawning on them at this particular moment, and they're still coping with the results of the research. But they are quite thrilled right now, and I think one of the reasons is because it paints Canadians not in the light of cannon fodder, the way we always sort of looked at ourselves, being tossed by our imperial masters to our doom. But rather, it paints a picture that Canadians were actually standing shoulder to shoulder with the British, very much the way we are today in NATO. So it may be the way we look at Dieppe could be interpreted as our first sojourn into truly being part of an allied force. So I think the Canadian government in this case, although I can't speak for them, the impression I get from meetings I've had is that they are quite thrilled with the findings.
The film is called Dieppe Uncovered, and it is on the History Channel and will be repeated on History Channel, so you can always check your local listings. For those who are outside of Canada or who don't have the History Channel, are there ways of seeing the film? Will the film eventually be for sale?
That's the idea. We're in discussions right now, and we're hoping to get a worldwide release very soon. As a matter of fact, look for it probably in November of 2012.
Excellent. Thank you very much, David, for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you, Peter. Anytime.
Military historian David O'Keefe. His documentary, Dieppe Uncovered, is airing in Canada on the History Channel. You can check their local listings for the schedule.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to author Raymond Benson about his series of books called The Black Stiletto. And Stuart Nolman, speaking of books, is on with another edition of Book Banter. He'll be in with a review. And, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day and more Stuff File news right here, right now. Well, police were called to a Waffle House over a little domestic dispute over coffee. According to officers, a man and woman left the restaurant and took their coffee mugs with them. They were intercepted by another woman, the report did not indicate if she was a Waffle House employee or not, who then confronted them about the coffee mugs. The man poured out his coffee on the ground and handed over the cup. However, the woman allegedly proceeded to pour her coffee over the woman's head. As the woman took the mug from her and turned around to go back into the restaurant, the customer then allegedly punched her in the back. Ironically, all of this happened in a small Florida town called Niceville. Amazingly, and perhaps keeping in with the town's namesake, the victim chose not to press charges against her attacker. How nice. Yes. And there's a major scandal coming out of the National Scrabble Championship in Orlando, Florida. For the first time in the tournament's history, a competitor was escorted off the premises for cheating. The young male, who cannot be named for legal reasons, apparently snuck in two blank tiles. And any Scrabble player worth their weight in dictionaries knows a blank tile is essentially gold bullion in the word-making world. Now, the cheater was discovered when he accidentally and stupidly dropped the tiles on the floor. John D. Williams Jr. from the National Scrabble Association said cheating has been known to happen, but at smaller regional events, and has never happened at national level before. This is apparently huge in the Scrabble world, and the internet Scrabble community is just abuzz. Yeah, I'll bet. Apparently they're coming up with a host of seven-letter words to express their indignation. And Christy Ross, who owns Video Cafe in Coates, North Carolina, said she's tired of people who don't pay their late fees or return videos and games. So she's now installed a large white board at the store bearing the names of about 300 people whom she says collectively owe her about $26,000. She's also taken pictures of the whiteboard and posted it on Facebook for the entire world to see. Ross says, "It's hard to replace an $80 video game if the first time you rent it, they don't bring it back. It probably is harsh, but the way I look at it, a lot of these people have cussed us. They have told us, who cares about late fees?" Her plan seems to be working as she says many fees have been paid off as a result of the public shaming. Ross says she's made sure to check with her attorney before launching the plan and claims it's all on the legal up and up because renters sign a contract when opening their accounts. In other breaking news, video rental stores are still open for business. Who knew? Who out there is still renting a video? I mean, I have two working VCRs, but who knows how long they'll be working? Because if anything happens with them, where are you going to find parts? Nobody sells VCRs anymore. Anyway, we have time for one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Chicago recently staged its annual gun buyback program, offering a $100 gift card for every firearm turned in with no questions asked. We might add that the Windy City is in the middle of its worst homicide epidemic in years, in which 259 have died on city streets in the first 6 months of 2012. However, the program appears to be, inadvertently, a win-win project for both anti- and pro-gun advocates. This year, 5,500 guns, including several machine guns, were turned in and taken off the streets, bringing the total to 23,000 since the program was started. Ironically, 60 of this year's guns were handed in by a local pro-gun organization called Guns Save Life. They announced that they would be using their $6,000 in gift cards to buy ammunition for a National Rifle Association-supported shooting camp for kids. Okay, nobody sees a problem with this? Huh? Really? Okay. Let's just get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Raymond Benson is a prolific writer who has written many novels. He was also the only American commissioned to pen original James Bond adventures. We last spoke with him when he published Dark Side of the Morgue, and since then, he's released The Black Stiletto, a unique twist on the crime fighter genre. And Raymond is on the line with us right now from Illinois. Hi, Raymond.
Hey, how are you? Long time no speak.
Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you've created this new story over several stories, The Black Stiletto, which is sort of a story within a story, right?
Yeah. The Black Stiletto, in fictional terms, she was a vigilante in the late 1950s, 1960s, costume vigilante, kind of a female version of the Shadow. And she, you know, fought crime and social injustice, and she was active for about 5 years, and then she mysteriously disappeared. Nobody knew who she was. And in the ensuing years, she kind of became a pop culture icon with, you know, comic books about her, and sort of, you know, she became the stuff of myth. Then we cut to the present, and a grown man is taking care of his elderly mother who has Alzheimer's in a nursing home, and he discovers, lo and behold, that she was the Black Stiletto. And this is like big news. This is equal to, you know, who shot JFK. So it's two parallel stories, one in the present and one in the past, and it's going to be 5 books, and 2 of them are out already.
Now, when you first started this, did you say to yourself, this will be 5 books? Or as you were writing, you realized, I have enough for 5 books?
I began it as I said, this is going to be a 5-book series.
And when you first focused on doing The Black Stiletto, were you thinking of everything that might come with it? For instance, potential movies or television shows, the like?
Well, sure. I always try when I write an original novel that it would have movie potential. That's, you know, any smart writer would do that. As a matter of fact, the film and TV rights have been acquired. So, we're keeping our fingers crossed that something might happen. I'd love to see it adapted into graphic novels or, you know, comics, real comics. I think it just, you know, it has that potential, I think, to be a franchise. I have a dedicated website, theblackstiletto.net, and there's a video that I wrote and produced, and a friend of mine directed and edited in Hollywood, and it's a promo for the first book. It came out about a year ago. So we did that. A friend of mine did a theme song for The Black Stiletto, and he recorded it in a studio with a full band. And that song is free, downloadable from the website. There's a free short story, Black Stiletto short story, that anyone can download from the website. So I'm really trying to, you know, get The Black Stiletto out there.
Now, it's interesting when you do a story like this that has, as you say, parallel stories going along with it. You know, the one thing about our superheroes, and we see this all the time with the constant reboots both in comic books and in movies, no one likes to see our superheroes age. But here you have a story where you hear of what happens to a particular character later in life.
Right, exactly. And it's not pretty. I mean, you know, Alzheimer's, you know, the books also, you know, deal very much with Alzheimer's. So it's not only, you know, a comic book action adventure story, but at the heart of it, it's a family story and about a mother and her son and the secrets that we keep from each other all through our lives and how relationships really survive. And that's really what the books are about.
You've touched on so many things that you don't see a lot of in the comic book genre, in the superhero genre, and the fact, first of all, you're writing about a female character.
Mm-hmm.
She has an offspring, which you don't hear about very often in these types of stories. And again, as I say, you touched on the Alzheimer's thing. Was it a conscious effort when you started writing this? And what was the genesis for coming up with this particular character?
Well, very early 2009 or maybe late 2008, I was with my literary manager and we were having lunch and he said, you need to come up with something that women would like because the biggest percentage of readers or book buyers are women. So I facetiously, I said, well, how about a female superhero? And we laughed, and then he went, you know, that's not a bad idea. So I went home and thought about it and, I wanted to do something very, very realistic. Watchmen kind of had a realistic slant on it, but those were real super. I mean, they had superpowers and stuff, so it was still had one foot in fantasy. Well, this one does too. But I wanted to really place a woman realistically in the real world as who is a vigilante. And secondly, I already had a story brewing in my mind about a grown son, who is taking care of his mother who has Alzheimer's, and he discovers some kind of secret about her, some dark secret about her past. And I didn't know what that was. But so I melded the two together, and it just worked, you know, it just fit right in.
As you were writing the stories, and as you say, you always think of what's going to happen to your characters beyond the word on the page, be it film or television. Do you think about who might be cast as the Black Stiletto? Who would you like to see in the role?
Oh, gee. You know, we're always told not to really even say things like that because it could hurt our chances. But there's a number of actresses. I mean, the character in the late 50s, early 60s part of it, the past, she's in her early 20s. She's like 20, 21, 22, 23. So we'd need somebody very athletic, of course, somebody very tall, and somebody who can act. I think, Emma Stone would be really good. I think Evan Rachel Wood would be pretty good. There's quite a few.
The first two have already come out, as you say, the first two of the five.
Right, yeah, the first two are available.
And when will we see the compilation of the work? When will we see the fifth one come out, the third, fourth, and fifth?
Well, one comes out every year. So the third book will come out in the spring of 2013. I imagine the fourth one will be a year later, and the last one will be a year after that.
Because the Black Stiletto is someone who is a vigilante crime fighter in a particular period, the 50s, I would assume a lot of the things that took place in that time period work its way into the book, be it communism and the Red Scare and
absolutely. And that's where I'm really having a fun as a writer, because I get to research all that stuff. It takes place in New York City, the first three books do. The second two books takes place in L.A., but New York in that time period, yeah, it was very different. And I do bring in a lot of the pop culture of the time. And, you know, she's an Elvis fan. So we learn a lot about Elvis in these books. And, you know, she tackles the social injustices of the time. The second book has to do with race relations in 1959. New York. And she starts reading about Martin Luther King and thinking he's really cool. And she works actually at a gymnasium, a men's gymnasium, sort of as the cleaning woman in the that's like her day job. And so she gets to know a lot of African Americans, and the bad guys in the second book are also African Americans. So she gets that's why it's called The Black Stiletto, Black and White. So it's provocative. The third book is going to deal with the Kennedy Nixon campaign, presidential campaign. She actually in her civilian life volunteers for Kennedy's campaign in New York, and so there's all kinds of stuff like that in the books.
Do you ever worry with today's short attention span theater and sometimes people focusing too much on what is current, that were you worried at all that some younger audience might not be keen on going back into history? In other words, who was your target audience?
Well, I'm finding that that women like it, just women, period, which is good. That was my intention. But men, I'm finding like it too. But the biggest people who have been vocal about it are like the over 30s, over 40s. So yeah, it's a baby boomer audience is certainly gonna probably get more of the references than a younger audience. But to see that it's got the Comic-Con geekness that should appeal to the kids, to the younger crowd.
The book is called The Black Stiletto. It's one of a series of five books. The website, as you mentioned, is theblackstiletto.net, correct?
That's right.
Raymond, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. I want to get to talk to you about the world of James Bond, and we have interesting news about that pertaining to you. Do you want to come back in a couple of weeks and talk about that as well?
Yes, we can do that. And I should probably point out, you had mentioned that I was the only American to write Bond novels. It's actually not true. I was the first American. Jeffrey Deaver was the last guy, and he's American.
Okay. So we'll touch base in a couple of weeks and talk about all things Bond.
Okay, thank you.
Raymond Benson, author of The Black Stiletto. His website for the book is theblackstiletto.net, and you'll find that great video trailer that he was talking about right there on the front page of the site. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0157, and you'll find links to Raymond's sites, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. If there's one warning label that virtually everyone in America has seen, it would probably be the one found on pillows. There's a lot of confusion about those pillow tags. Can we remove them or not? However, if you actually make a pillow, they're not only confusing, they're expensive. Carrie Smith was expecting her first child when she developed a unique design for a pillow that made her more comfortable. Other pregnant women liked it too, so she decided to sell them. Then she found out that 15 states have special laws just about pillow tags. The cost of complying with all those laws? $4,000. Let's be fair, selling a pillow isn't easy in America. One of the winners of our Wacky Warning Labels contest this year was found on a travel pillow made specifically for children. It's a great product, but it actually came with a warning saying, "Keep product away from children." With all of these pillow warnings, it's no wonder so many of us have a hard time sleeping at night. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And Stuart Nallman is once again with us for another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hello, Pete. Well, you ever heard of the B-52s, right?
The plane or the group?
The group.
Yes.
Okay. From their first album, the first song on there was called Planet Claire. I don't know if you
yes,
probably...
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go to a planet, but it's not Planet Claire.
Okay.
It's for all you young adult readers out there. It's called Planet Tad.
Planet Tad. Is it anywhere near Planet Claire?
Far from it.
Okay.
Two different extremes right there.
Okay.
Now, it used to be an unwritten rule of thumb, Peter, that tweens who kept diaries kept them to themselves, for their eyes only, basically, which explains the lock and key that were usually part of a diary book. Now, anyone who dared to open up these secret diaries and read passages from them and were caught faced the wrath of the diarist in question, which for many in that age group meant a fate worse than death. However, there have been cases where the secret diary of a tween has become the premise of a series of humorous books that have become bestsellers amongst the young adult or YA literary scene. The Adrian Mole books and the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series are two bold examples of this YA genre, and has now been taken to its next logical level with Planet Tad, a blog that chronicles the life and everyday foibles of Tad, a 12-year-old middle school adolescent boy, which has become a regular feature in Mad Magazine, and now The Misadventures of Tad and His Planet is now available in book form. Now, it's written by Tim Carvel, who is the head writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and the book covers an entire year in Tad's life as he tries to survive life as a grade 7 student with his mom and dad and his precociously smart younger sister Sophie and his best friend Chuck. Now, it takes in the form of a digital blog diary in which Tad keeps track of what's going on with his life at home and at school, along with some random reflections and emotions that express what kind of mood he is in a particular day that he's writing about. Now, what he goes through easily reflects what any 12-year-old goes through, which is why readers of that age group will easily identify with and enjoy this book. There's his quest to make the ultimate erupting volcano for the school science fair, tracking down a school's secret admirer with disastrous, hilarious results. The quest for the best costume when he's invited to a Halloween party. He wanted to dress up with his friend Chuck as the Men in Black, but ends up as one of the characters from Avatar when Chuck gets sick and the rest of the kids confuse him for a Smurf. Then there's Tad's first summer job working for the Hot Dog Pound restaurant, parading outside the place wearing the mascot's costume in very hot weather. His unsuccessful attempts to woo Jenny Backman, the prettiest girl in his class, and the buzz cut he gets just in time for his annual school portrait. Now, what makes Planet Tad so enjoyable, even for adult readers, is how Carvel uses his talents as a professional comedy writer to make the text so readable for any age group. It's juvenile in tone without being too overly juvenile, which makes many of Tad's reactions to his situations and random reflections almost reading like a – sounds like a typical stand-up comedy routine. Now, Planet Tad is a book that gives a funny modern spin to the angst-ridden teenage diary books that young adult readers love to read. I only hope that Carvel has plenty more frustrating misadventures for his likable, delightful, hapless tween.
I sense a book coming out of you, though, called Stewed, The Nullman Chronicles.
But I have to, you know, I have to re-spell the word, of course. I mean, it has to be S-T-E-W-E-D. Because if I did it with, you know, a shortened version of the way my name is spelled, it'd be Stewed. People get confused. That wouldn't be good, would it?
No, it wouldn't.
Oh. No. And also, I just want to recommend a couple of other books, like I just mentioned just beforehand. The Adrian Mole Diaries by Sue Patterson and the Diary of Wimpy Kid books, which they're both hilarious and they're both well-written. And I think Sue Townsend's books, the Adrian Mole Diaries, I think really set the trend of books that you know, like the Diary of Wimpy Kid books and also the Planet Tad book, which probably more books than where that came from. I recommend both of them very highly, one for just how well-written it is and just covering, you know, what it was like to be a teenager, and also just the funny foibles and misadventures of being a teenager or tween, for that matter.
You know, you've mentioned on this particular edition of the Stuff File program a book that was written by a comedy writer, and 2 weeks ago you mentioned another book that was written by a comedy writer. And, of course, last month you were involved heavily in the Just for Laughs Festival, which all dealt with comedy. So let me add another comedy name out there who's a writer as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with his work. You probably are, though. Andy Borowitz.
Oh, yes. Very, very popular, humorous and satirical writer.
Who does the Borowitz Report, which, as of last month, is actually in The New Yorker now.
Oh, really? So he's really made it.
Yeah, so it's ironic because the kind of writing that he does and the fact that it's all completely fictional based on true things, it's ironic that they would put it in something like The New Yorker, which is one of those magazines that is a fact-checking machine. So I'm sure there are some people who read The New Yorker who will probably think that what he's writing about is true and will miss his satire. But hey, that's the price they'll have to pay. But it's very funny stuff. So I suggest you check it out and follow his tweets, because he's also an amazing Twitter writer as well.
I'm gonna have to add him to my list of followers, actually.
Absolutely. You should be definitely following him. So anyway, Planet Tad, tell us where we can find it, where we can get it.
Well, it's by Tim Carvel, Planet Tad, and it's published by Harper. And it's $14.99. Find it in the young adult section of your local bookstore.
The young adult section. And how can we find you?
Well, you can find me slipping between the pages of the West End Times, both my Book Banter column, my Grapevine column. But if you can't read me on paper, you can read me online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
You're welcome, Peter. Now I'm going to blast off to Planet Tad.
Okay, Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed, of course, have an Idiot of the Day coming your way. But first, more Stuff File news right here, right now, for your listening pleasure. When Stephen Cadwalder, age 56, stopped by the Middlesex Township Police Department, he wanted to file a complaint. He threatened to sue the town over his arrest for drunk driving the night before, but before he could file a formal complaint, officers arrested him because he was visibly intoxicated, they say, and had driven to the police station. With his second drunk driving arrest in less than 24 hours, the judge set his bail at $150,000. You know, that's just one of the problems with drunks. They don't know when to shut the hell up. Anyway, clerks at a Walmart store in Winter Haven, Florida, called police when they saw a man drink a beer outside the store, come into the store, then go straight to the sporting goods counter, put a revolver on the counter, and ask for ammunition to fit it. The clerk refused. The man argued with the clerk, then walked away. When he saw police approaching him, he started screaming that it was his First Amendment right to bear arms. Rodney Jean Lewis, age 24, was arrested on multiple charges, including weapons violations and public intoxication. Okay, first of all, the right to bear arms is the Second Amendment. The First Amendment is the right to free speech. However, once again, drunks don't know when to shut the hell up. Police in Sioux City, Iowa, say a man hid in the bushes behind a house at 10:30 p.m., and when a woman walked near him, he jumped out, roared at her, and then ran. A short time later, another report came in. A man broke into a house, got down on his hands and knees, according to Police Lieutenant Mark Kirkpatrick, and started barking at the dog in the residence. Investigators identified the suspect in both cases as Ryan Heck, age 28, and charged him with serious assault, public intoxication, there we go again, trespassing, and criminal mischief. You know, if you remove the intoxication aspect, this kind of story is cute if the perpetrator is 8 years old. Not so much so when he's an adult. Okay, we have a couple of specialist perps here for you. In May, in Chicago, Chicago police arrested a man they believe had just minutes earlier used a Bobcat front-end loader to crash through the window of a Family Dollar store and steal two cans of deodorant and a handful of greeting cards and nothing else. And he just walked away. And specialist perps number two, a police in Lorain, Ohio, were looking in June for a black man about 18 years old who had been seen on surveillance video breaking into the same Sunoco convenience store several times recently and taking up to $600 worth of Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Talk about specializing, huh? Well, everyone's got to have a specialty, I guess. In Gainesville, Florida, a police officer attempted to pull over 35-year-old Mandy Ramsey for speeding, but rather than stop, Mandy allegedly turned down another street and sped off. Her truck reportedly ran a stop sign and nicked an oak tree in the process. Eventually, she was stopped by police and then had some explaining to do. Mandy told officers the reason she did not stop was, well, because she was driving topless at the time and she was embarrassed. She didn't offer a reason as to why she had made that particular wardrobe choice, or lack of wardrobe choice. Clearly, she's not understanding the concept of driving with your top down. Usually, we mean the car. Anyway, we've got a new Jesus sighting, this time from 80-year-old Edward Garza, who believes he saw an image of his Lord and Savior burned into his breakfast taco at La Amistad Adult Daycare in Beeville, Texas. Ed says he poked and prodded the taco before eating it, and it fell open by itself. That's when he saw it, the appearance of Jesus staring back at him from a tortilla, or at least he thinks so. The director of the daycare for seniors, Angie Rodriguez, called the discovery a miracle. She says she's going through some personal tough times, and she'd prayed to God for a sign the night before. Well, there you go. The Lord does work in mysterious ways. And in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, 24-year-old Tiffany Sherry was doing her best to finish doing the dishes, despite the fact that she was suffering from a very bad sunburn. Now, while working through her pain, her boyfriend, Michael Martinez, decided this would be the perfect time to give her a playful, albeit painful, smack on the butt. So he did. Not surprisingly, Tiffany, was not too happy and quickly spun around, brandishing a large steak knife. Mike quickly came to the realization that his girlfriend was about to repay the pain he had just caused her in spades, so he backed into the living room where Tiffany's children were playing and said, "What are you going to do, stab me in front of your children?" Well, famous last words. Tiffany quickly came to her senses and calmly asked her kids to leave the room. She then allegedly proceeded to stab Michael in the stomach and the shoulder. As he turned to flee, she stabbed him again in the upper back while screaming that she was going to kill him. Michael ran back into his house and called the police. He was taken to St. Luke's Hospital for treatment while Tiffany was arrested and charged with aggravated assault, simple assault, making terroristic threats, and reckless endangerment. Interesting to note that apparently cutlery is Tiffany's traditional weapon of choice. In 2008, she was also arrested for stabbing a man with a fork in the middle of an argument over diapers. Well, I get the feeling she won't be seeing the sun for quite a while. Anyway, time for this week's Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the Idiot of the Day.
An unidentified 34-year-old man reported to police in Hanover, Pennsylvania, that he was accosted on the street. A man wanted to use his cell phone. He refused, so the man pulled a knife and took it from him. After reporting the robbery to police, the victim went out and got a new phone and downloaded all of his data from his carrier, including his photos. But there were more photos than he had taken himself. The robber had taken some self-portraits, according to Police Chief Randy Whitson. The victim identified the pictured man as his robber, and police arrested Dylan Tyler Hankowitz, age 18, charging him with the crime. "It's one of those things that sort of makes you chuckle," Whitson said. "I guess he didn't know about the cloud." Now, why is it that every person who steals an item that can take a picture always takes a picture of themselves? One reason, and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0157. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0157. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air at World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.